PFLAG Canada is there when it seems no one else is. Are you struggling with an LGBT issue? Every day, PFLAG Canada volunteers are contacted by frightened kids and by angry, fearful, or ashamed parents. PFLAG is Canada's only national organization that helps all Canadians who are struggling with issues of sexual orientation and gender identity. PFLAG Canada supports, educates, and provides resources 24/7. Visit pflagcanada.ca.
Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
In the next hour, CJSF 90.1 FM brings you a collection of short radio documentaries produced by students of BCIT's broadcast journalism program. In the first documentary, Made in Hastings, Sham and Dave examine issues of addiction, public health, and criminalization in Vancouver's downtown east side.
People on the streets, severely addicted, always trying to generate the pennies that maybe turn into the dollars, that turn into $5, that will get you not high, but unsick. Once you've managed to scrape money together, you need to try and acquire your drugs without getting beaten up, bunked, which is sold phony drugs, or busted by the police. There's that fraught process. You are getting more and more desperate and dope sick. Now you finally manage to acquire the drugs and you have to get them in you. People hide in doorways. Many, many people go into the alleys and use behind dumpsters, which is a good place to hide. Now, needless to say, dumpsters in an area that faces a high percentage of homeless people, that area behind dumpsters is also used as the public toilet for the neighborhood. So it is probably the least hygienic area on earth for a medical procedure. But that's where that is being performed. And you are trying to get this fixing as quickly as possible, standing behind the dumpster. Your feet are in human waste. And you get your rig out and you get your dope out. You do not have the space, nor do you have the time to filter these drugs. You dump them into the end of the rig, and you will be doing what's called a shake and bake. You put the drugs and the water in the rig, you put the capper back, the plunger back in, shake your rig, run your lighter or your torch under it. That is not killing bacteria. It's not going to raise the temperature enough. You have this unfiltered drug in there, and after doing that as briefly as possible, then you need to find a vein. So what happens is you are looking for a vein, and you're looking up, looking for cops, looking at your vein, looking up, looking for cops. You're multitasking where you need to be single-tasking. That's disaster enough, but there's further indignity if you overdose. And then being hidden behind a dumpster is a real disaster because nobody's going to see you, and when you are found, chances are you're going to be dead.
Should the person described in this scene go to the hospital or to prison? Are they sick or are they a criminal? Addiction is a health problem. Drug use should not be treated with criminal penalties. Whether it's cigarettes, alcohol, or heroin, addiction is a health concern and needs to be treated as such. Unfortunately, addiction to Schedule I drugs like cocaine, crystal meth, or heroin will land someone in prison long before they see a healthcare professional. Despite ever-increasing investment from governments and law enforcement, the use of illicit drugs has seen no significant reduction. Furthermore, those engaged in the drug trade have found increasingly sophisticated ways to make their actions lucrative. Clearly, there is a need for a policy shift, at least when considering use, possession, and addiction. Harm reduction needs to become the leading strategy when addressing illicit drugs. This is the only way any profound and lasting results can be attained. Vancouver's downtown east side is home to one of the most severely drug-addicted communities in Canada. It is also home to Insight, a safe injection site that works to minimize the harm Schedule I drugs exact on people living in that area. Insight's approach to addiction is harm reduction, the strategy that works to minimize the negative effects drugs have on a group of people. it is a controversial approach. Its opponents often view it as a form of enablement. They believe that those who practice harm reduction have condemned the user to a lifetime of addiction and are simply guiding them to an early grave. This is Conservative Health Minister Tony Clement sharing his views on insight, safe injection sites, and harm reduction.
But for the poorest of Canadians who live in conditions of extreme poverty, enslaved by an addiction for which full recovery is possible, we have been offering supervised injection, needle exchanges and crack pipes. We have been offering drug maintenance rather than drug treatment. We have been sending a message, we have given up on you. We do not expect you to recover. Now, Vancouver Mayor Sam Sullivan, just a few weeks ago in an editorial in the Globe and Mail, called the SIS, quote, palliative care. This echoed the report of a committee struck by the BC Medical Association in 1997, which called harm reduction, quote, the palliative care of addictions medicine. Palliative care is what you give someone when there is no more hope. It is end-stage treatment when every other solution has failed and we just wait for people to die. But injection drug users do not necessarily have to die. There is still hope for them. Even if they fail treatment the first time, we can help them to get up and to try again. In purely medical terms, it is unethical to offer palliative care when treatment could help. I would want health workers, and more importantly, I would like my government not to give up on my child, but to help me win him or her back into society and into health and wellness. That is what this government's national anti-drug strategy is all about, and what we need to think about when addressing the exemption at Insight. This much I know as Health Minister, the illicit drugs that which are being injected as part of harm reduction at the supervised injection site are harmful to human health. In my opinion, supervised injection is not medicine. It does not heal the person addicted to drugs. Each and every injection, along with the heroin and cocaine injected, harms the person. Injection not only causes physical harm, it also deepens and prolongs the addiction. Programs to support supervised injection divert valuable dollars away from treatment, and government-sponsored supervised injection sends a very mixed message to young people who are contemplating the illicit use of drugs.
Minister Clement's summary of Insight's purpose is oversimplified and incomplete. He labels it as palliative care, but doesn't mention the life-saving and rehabilitative medical services that take place there every day. This is Darwin Fisher, the manager of Insight, explaining how the facility runs on a daily basis.
The primary goal of Insight is to reduce overdose deaths, in fact, to prevent overdose deaths on the premises. We have had thousands of overdose interventions without fatality here, right? The second priority here is to reduce the spread of disease. We do that, and I mean harm reduction, as we talk about it, becomes so basic in some ways. To be able to inject where there is running water and soap so you can wash your hands in the injection site before you inject. We haven't even gotten to talking about clean equipment, nursing care, better injection practices, things like that. But those are really important as well. Single use to a booth, trying to put some order to a phenomenon that out in the street is absolutely chaotic is one of the goals here, and disease prevention is a primary goal that way. The third aspect of the mandate is to try and build relationships and trust and to treat with respect this incredibly marginalized population that a lot of times wants to go absolutely the opposite direction when they see representatives from, you know, society's various bureaucracies, whether that's the hospital system, the welfare system, or the police system, right? We need to sort of reach out from society and see if we can make a bond with the people that use this site. The research that has been done has actually shown that there's a decrease in this specific area that we are, and that's largely our catchment around the 100 block, which is where most of British Columbia and Vancouver's entrenched addicts reside, right? Mm-hmm. And there is a reduction in overdose mortalities in this area, which I think is attributable to this site. We, at times, a great, great deal, about 80% of the injections that get performed here are performed by under 20% of that 13,000 person database, meaning that core group of 2,000 to 3,000 people. They live in the area, they are predominantly homeless. For many of them, this is their primary health service. I do not go to a clinic, I do not go to the emergency room unless I have to. Insight is the only place that I'm seeing healthcare professionals, and it is that group that is the most at risk and the most marginalized and the most chaotic that forms the largest group of people that are here day after day after day. And that, I think, is the highest risk group for overdose in this country. And ministering to that group, having the Muse here, having oxygen, having Narcan, having observation, you know, observant staff looking at them, that is having a significant reduction of that overdose number. And the idea was that we would try and have access to other services from this. The most notable service that is directly on top of us is on-site detox.
Minister Clement says that the conservative anti-drug strategy is one based on treatment. Yet, the treatment they provide, through investment in traditional healthcare, is not easily accessible to this severely drug-addicted and marginalized population. Clement's definition of treatment has also manifested in the form of harsher punishment. While the Vancouver Police Department has supported Insight's presence in the downtown east side, the federal government and the RCMP believe that stricter enforcement of drug laws is needed to curb drug use. They believe that this will act as an effective deterrent in reducing the number of people who start using drugs and therefore become addicted. This legislation assumes that addicts are thinking logically and have the foresight of a typical, well-adjusted person. But they don't. This strategy falls short because addicts aren't looking beyond the next fix. By no means are they in a healthy mental state. Regardless of why an addict starts using drugs, their continued use is simply to avoid becoming dope sick. Dope sick is the intense physical need and desperation for another fix caused by drug withdrawal. At this point, an addict isn't using to get high. They're simply using to return to a level of physical and mental normality. This dependency ensures demand remains high. And even though it is this dependency that fuels the drug trade, current laws fail to address it. Rather, legislation works to remove addicts and dealers from neighborhoods like the downtown east side, creating a vacuum that other addicts and other dealers will eventually fill. Isan Jozagi is a master's student in the School of Criminology at Simon Fraser University. His research focuses on the impact Insight has had on the downtown east side community. Now, he counters Clement's assertion that harm reduction is just a death sentence. Jozagi believes that harm reduction is in fact an effective strategy with both personal and economic benefits. With Insight acting as a stabilizing force in the downtown east side, addicts can start to manage their addiction and then begin to contribute back to society.
You can't make somebody stop using drugs because their body needs it. Unfortunately, after a point, there is no return. After some point, when somebody starts using drugs, once they reach that point, they can never go back. They can, but it's going to cost a lot of money for society. So what we can do is reduce the HIV and hepatitis C transmission. Each HIV case is, on average, costs $150,000 to $250,000 to taxpayers' money. So it's a lot of money. Hepatitis C is the same thing. Hepatitis C is cost a lot of money to be treated. So what happens if we give free heroin to people who are truly addicted and been addicted for a long time? It reduces the cost of criminal justice system. People are less likely to go to jail, to cost the taxpayers money, less likely to commit crimes. If we could reduce the criminal activity in the downtown east side by providing free heroin, we can actually not only reduce crime in the neighborhood, we could create safety in the neighborhood, we could destabilize the peoples who are addicted to it, and maybe they're able to find jobs and contribute to the economy. Mm-hmm. Research shows, which is NOAMI, have you heard about it? North American Opiate Medication Initiative, which is a program that has been run from Montreal and Vancouver, which provided free heroin to users who qualified for the program. They've been users for a long time. So what happened was that people were able to stabilize their lives. They're able to reduce their intake of drugs. Some people are able to, once they get their heroin, they're able to function. They're able to go to work. They're able to pay their taxes and contribute to society. Before the supervised injection facility opened in the downtown east side, it was a situation where you had people overdosing every day in the alleys, you would see the HIV and hepatitis C epidemic, same as some third world countries in Africa. It was that bad. 25% HIV rates, 90% hepatitis C transmission rates. It's unbelievable. It's the only one in North America it's that bad. Mm-hmm. So, like, the government had no choice. They had to do something. And the only thing they could do is reduce harm. Because you can't fix somebody overnight. You can't tell them not to use drugs. Drug addiction is a health problem, not a criminal justice issue.
This evidence shows the positive impact safe injection facilities can have for impoverished, drug-addicted communities. Yet the RCMP still believe that harm reduction does not attempt to decrease drug use or effectively fight the harmful repercussions of addiction. Chuck Doucette worked for the RCMP for 35 years before retiring in 2007. More than 30 years were spent in various roles with RCMP Drug Enforcement in Vancouver. For over a decade, he served as the Drug Awareness Coordinator for BC and the Yukon. In 2009, Doucette did an interview with Canada's C2C online journal. He was quoted as saying,
"The definition of harm reduction is that we try to reduce the harms to a drug user without trying to get them to stop using the drug. This creates a cycle of drug use with no end in sight. I visualize it this way. It's like you have a pool of deep water. There are people constantly falling into the pool and can't get out. If they stay there, they will eventually drown. Prevention strategies would be teaching them not to go close enough to fall into the pool. Treatment would be pulling them out of the pool. Enforcement is like putting up fences to keep them away from the pool. Harm reduction, however, is like throwing them a life jacket and letting them stay in the pool. You are never really dealing with the problem. Only prevention and treatment will reduce the number of people in the pool. Focusing solely on harm reduction allows the problem to keep on increasing. The strategy should always be on how to reduce the number of users in the first place."
Even more unsettling is policymakers' continued support for prevention tactics that do not work and simply exile users to the fringes of society.
Without a doubt, the biggest stereotype around harm reduction and around the supervised injection facility is that somehow this is abetting drug use or encouraging drug use. The idea that vexates me completely, that addicts need to have it a little tougher. The idea that addicts need to hit bottom before they're going to clean up. That making things a little bit worse, that making them feel a little bit less supported and a little bit more marginalized has some sort of healing property. This is complete bullshit. And the idea that treating someone with respect, with human decency, that warmth, that lights, that running water, that clean equipment somehow is encouraging people to use is absolutely ridiculous, because addiction has its roots and it breeds in trauma. Trauma. And there are emotional and psychological issues that the people that use this site are plagued with. The backgrounds that they come from, the entrenched users, are filled with childhood sexual abuse, childhood violent abuse, childhood homelessness, grinding poverty. These are the precursors and the abettors of addiction. Clean running water, friendly staff, these things help stabilize and reduce addiction. So this idea, again, of addicts having to hit bottom, you know, and that if we prevent them from hitting bottom, we're somehow keeping them from getting to that point where they're finally changed and burst into sobriety, this is a religious and moral narrative that is absolutely bankrupt. These black and white narratives, damned when you're an addict, and you need to just get right to the fucking bottom level of hell, and then suddenly, like a phoenix, you will be saved and emerge into the light as a sober person for the rest of your life. What a harsh black and white image that is. It goes completely against the common sense grain of incremental change. I don't know if you've ever changed on a dime and changed your life all of a sudden, and today was the first day of the rest of your life. We don't fucking do that shit, you know? We change with repeated attempts slowly, and change happens best when we barely notice.
Whether or not addiction stems from social pressures or misguided behavior, the problem of addiction will not be resolved until it is treated as a medical issue. The goal of criminalizing drug use is to reduce the prevalence of addiction and its detrimental results. But, by looking at the downtown east side, it's clear Canadian policy has failed. By framing drug addiction as a health issue instead of a criminal matter, users are viewed as people and not deviants. This shift in perspective is vital to building a social infrastructure that is capable of dealing with the problems that arise from substance abuse. The facts don't lie. From 2003 to 2010, Insight reduced HIV risk behavior in the downtown East Side by 70%. During these 7 years, Insight has treated approximately 1,800 overdoses without a single fatality. Here, harm reduction is practiced to its full potential. Lives are saved, disease is controlled, and addicts are rehabilitated. Users are dependent on Schedule I drugs because they lack an adequate support structure in their lives, like a job, a family, secure housing, and a community. These things would give them the sense of purpose and dignity needed to move beyond their addiction. Safe injection sites are more than just a place to safely shoot drugs. They are a key pillar for a very isolated population that has no other means for rebuilding a life that is about more than the next fix.
Walk away now, and you're gonna start a war.
It's not rocket science in a sense. It's, okay, what do you need? How can we suss out all the available options? And the idea was that we would try and have access to other services from this. The most notable service that is directly on top of us is on-site detox. So the idea, we can get people right in the area where they are as well as we can, and that we can try and lever people into higher threshold medical services that they need. How can we get you involved in this process? And you're in charge of the outcome and the path you want to take. We I don't want to force anything on you. I want you to be directing this process whenever possible. The idea that change is an incremental thing, inculcating that approach in people, being very congratulatory about the contemplation of detox or wellness, you know, but centering that within the person, not externally. When people feel that they owe their sobriety to an external force, that to me is a very weak position. So anything we can do to awaken people's drive towards wellness as the primary engine of their wellness is really, really important. Now, when people go upstairs, very often we're trying to connect them with appropriate treatment programs or appropriate housing or medical care. What they need is a sense of community, a sense of direction, basic health care, basic living standards, and you know, maybe they might need a little bit of counseling or care that way, but they're enormously self-directed. The issue is, after you get done with the arc of your treatment, what do you go on to? Do you have housing at the end of it? Do you have some new place in the community at the end of it? We need something to sort of fill the back end of that continuum after treatment to give people something else to move on to.
That was Maine and Hastings by Sham and Dave. In this next short, Jay and Drew take a look at medical cannabis and the stigma surrounding it.
Over 3,000 years ago in Asia, a natural medicine was discovered. As time passed, it migrated to North America. Used primarily as a hypnotic, cannabis was found to be helpful for treating many conditions and symptoms. Physicians thought it was safer than opium, but less reliable. In the 1900s, prescription barbiturates and aspirin became more widely used because of their fixed dosages and easily dispensed pill form. As recreational use of cannabis grew, so did prohibition, effectively ending its medical use. A medicine was marginalized by the war on drugs, and a shadow was cast over cannabis.
The Green Shadow, Medicinal Cannabis and Its Stigma.
When Paul Hunt was severely injured in a robbery, he looked to his psychiatrist for help with his conditions.
I guess it's a psychiatrist, if you're too strong about the use of cannabis, Well, he had him lay up one side of me and down the other, saying, if you ever mention that word again, or I says, I don't want to deal with you. You won't be coming to see me again anymore.
Stigma within the medical community has started to improve with more research and awareness about cannabis as a medicine.
I went to my GP. He signed right away, and it was because of UBC and the trials and herbal medicines and everything that they've done. And so the psychiatrist found a Jeff Strong. I was still a day patient. His secretary phoned me up and said, hey, that's it. Doesn't want to see you again.
Because of his struggles, Paul has taken it upon himself to help others and was the driving force behind the Green Cross Society opening its doors in BC.
You know, I can't work again, so I decided just to help other people just like me. And the Compassion Club was it brought me back to life.
The Green Cross is just one of the groups in BC helping those in need of medicinal cannabis. The BC Compassion Club is at the forefront of the natural wellness movement.
My name is Isaac K. Oman, and I am the communications coordinator at the BC Compassion Club Society. And basically what I do is a fair amount of outreach, which means working on the newsletter, doing presentations to...
The majority of patients at the Compassion Club are suffering from a chronic or ongoing condition, and we're seeking an alternative approach to prescription medication to deal with a long-term health problem. The clubs are supplying these patients with the medicine, but they're also helping to develop a community free of judgment and stigma. By educating and getting the patients actively involved in their health, they're reducing stigma and helping to normalize cannabis as a medicine.
And so what we try to do is really respect the neighborhood in terms of what it is. The schools have been really supportive of us. We actually have the school opposite... their 11th grade biology class comes over here to look at cannabis as part of their microbiology program. We've had a really great statement of support from their principal.
Changing public opinion and increased openness to alternative medicines has reopened the book of cannabis as a medicine. And now, here we are, torn between our drive to reduce crime tied to the drug trade and further our use of this medicine.
The Conservative government's position on the grow operations is not only putting a pinch on illegal growers, but is also hurting legitimate medicinal users.
Well, right now, from what I've heard, a lot of these illegal growers that are out there, they're shutting down a lot of them. For the cost of the marijuana is escalating. It's going up way high. It's going to be harder to find now.
Fighting a war on drugs while at the same time supplying medicine to its citizens. The Conservative government's commitment to the medical marijuana access regulation and reluctance to refer to this medicine as cannabis seems only to add to the stigma.
The federal government still uses the word marijuana in a lot of their in their federal program. That to marijuana spelled with an H. Both of those are slang terms. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about cannabis, we very much talk about it in terms of medicine. And so we refer to it as medical or medicinal cannabis. The government program is really interesting in that it was set up as a response to us, like our existence. Because several times over, courts had found that the government needs to support people more in terms of needing medical cannabis, and so they set up the MMAR program, which is the Medical Marijuana Access Regulations. And so they're not supplied by us, and their mode of operating is completely different in that it's all mail out. So they mail you your cannabis, or they allow you to grow for yourself, or they allow you to designate someone to grow for you. It's not the most efficient of methods because it's kind of set up very quickly, again, in response to what we were doing. And they're actually, because of the number of court decisions that have said that the program is unconstitutional, have had to kind of rethink the whole thing and are in the process of actually consulting with a large number of organizations in in terms of what their new program should look like.
With the newest round of budget cuts, the future of the MMAR is uncertain, to say the least. With a long, complicated application process